And welcome back to Dads on the Air, coming to you around Australia on the Community Radio Network. In this program, we bring you informing and entertaining conversations with a wide range of interesting people on topics of fatherhood, family and parenting, men's and boys' issues, and more. Hi, I'm Bill Cable, and our special guest today is Chris Hammer. Chris is the author of a new book, Treasure and Dirt. Chris was a journalist for more than 30 years, dividing his career between Australian federal politics and international news stories. For many years, he was a roving correspondent for SBS TV's flagship program, Dateline. Chris has reported from more than 30 countries on six continents, and since becoming a novelist, Chris's books, Scrublands, Silver, and Trust, have sold more than 250,000 copies over print and e-book. We last spoke to Chris about one of those books, Trust. Chris, welcome back to Dads on the Air.
Bill, so nice to be back with you.
Thank you. Well, the Treasure and Dirt story takes us to the outback after your previous book, Trust, was set in Sydney. Do you see this as an opportunity to introduce some new characters?
Yeah, so those first three books you mentioned, Scrublands, Silver and Trust, all feature the same main characters. They can be read as standalones, but they're also a type of series with a journalist, Martin Scarston, and his partner, Mandalay or Mandy Blonde. This book is new. This is a standalone book. Who knows, maybe it's the start of a new series. And it features two rather problematic police officers. There's Detective Sergeant Ivan Lukic. He's an experienced homicide detective from Sydney, and he's sent out to the outback, and he teams up with a very inexperienced, you know, freshly minted young detective, not a homicide detective, just a regular one, called Nell Buchanan, based out of Bourke, and they team up after a rather horrific murder.
Yes, it's interesting in the development of the characters because, as we find out, each one of them's got a flaw, and I find a lot. Everyone seems to have a story, and certainly your characters have a story, which we find out about.
Well, that was one of my problems with continuing the series with Martin and Mandy. We've learned a lot about them and their stories, so I didn't know where else I could go there. Mm. With these two, it's important because even though they're police officers and they're investigating a crime or a series of crimes, as it turns out, they're just not dispassionate, disinterested investigators, because what emerges in the book pretty quickly is that they've both got problems in their past that re-emerge as they're investigating, to the point that for each of them, their careers are under threat. And so they've got to decide, they don't really know each other, they've got to decide whether they trust each other, whether they cooperate, or whether maybe there's some advantage, certainly there's some temptation to sort of throw the other under the bus, as it were, you know, to help advance their own causes. So their own personal stories is tied up with their investigation.
You give a lot of detail about this fictional town of Finnegan's Gap. The people you describe in an Opal town as being bullshitters, dreamers, or both. Is it something to do with opals? Is it some sort of opal fever in these towns?
I mean, the town, Finnegan's Gap, is a fictionalised town. It's based rather loosely on Lightning Ridge in northern New South Wales, but it's a smaller, wilder, more desperate version than the real-life town. It's a great thing about fiction. You can emphasise some things, you can ignore others, and you can completely make up other facets. So it's definitely in the outback, and it's a pretty hot and dry and wild place. The great thing about mining towns is, opal mining towns, is that they're typically small claims. They're just one-man bands or partnerships, family affairs, and it's a very hard scrabble and tough existence. So it's a very good setting for a crime book.
And we find out very early in your book about ratters, which is a word I'd never heard before. Can you tell us a bit about ratters?
Yeah, sure. Look, let me just give you the setup for the book, because that'll probably help the listeners. And it's a crime fiction book, but this isn't really a spoiler, because this happens in the prologue, the first couple of pages of the book. We find ourselves with a team of ratters. Now, ratters are the lowest of the low. They are opal thieves. They sneak down their mates' mines in the middle of the night and steal their opals. You know, they get wind that someone's found a good batch of opals, and they go down and try and steal it. So the book starts with a team of these ratters, and they go down this mine. They've heard that this miner, Jonas McGee, is on a good streak. They go down, but instead of finding opals, they find him. He's been murdered. Not only has he been murdered, he's been crucified. And so these ratters, they get out of there pronto, because they don't want anything to do with it. But they've got enough conscience that they call the police. They leave an anonymous tip. And then the story proper starts with the arrival in the town of Ivan Lukic and Nell Buchanan. Now, ratters are a real thing. I didn't know any of this until I went up to Lightning Ridge last year. I walked into the miners' co-op there, looking for, you know, to see if I could find a miner who would take me down his mine and, you know, show me the ropes. And there on the wall was this big sign, sort of this cartoon of a rat with one of those red circles with a line through it. You know, those sort of like the things you have on non-smoke, you know, no smoking signs, that sort of thing. And there was a sign there, a dob in a ratter. So, of course, I said, look, what's a ratter? And they explained to me. And it's a real thing, and it's a real problem in these opal mining towns. So as soon as I heard that, I thought, I've got to use that in my book, surely.
It's a little subgroup of society that, work in the night and sneak in and out and destroy other people's slim chances of making a strike, I guess.
Yeah. So you can imagine how popular they'd be if they were ever discovered.
Your book is divided up into the days of the week, with from Sunday to Friday, and I guess this emphasises just how much is happening on a daily basis. The action, as you said just a minute ago, the action starts very early with that discovery, and I suppose it's an interesting discovery because it also might lead into some religious connotation.
Yeah, so this town where Ivan and Nell find themselves, Finnegan's Gap, it's a pretty wild place. There's a lot of these hard scrabble, tough, eccentric opal miners, including a bunch who live out at a squatter's camp called Dead Man's Wells. There's also a religious cult there called the Rapture that gets young adherents who come and get attached to this cult, and then they're sent there off opal mining, which makes them extremely unpopular in the town because most people are running one-man bands. There's a couple of billionaire miners. They're not opal miners, but they have big mines. One has a big coal mine nearby, and another is planning another mine, a rare earth mine. But they've been rivals for decades. And so there's another story there. So there's different... As Ivan and Nell sort of investigate the murder of this miner, they start uncovering other crimes. Some that have happened years before, some that have happened, one that's happened decades before, and another one, if you like, is still unfolding. So there's two or three different plot lines going on, plus, of course, what I said before, both Ivan and Nell find themselves under, you know, their own pressure and their own investigation.
Yeah, you just mentioned rare earth. Well, you know, that's very topical with a worldwide shortage of rare earth, and I think over-reliance on China at the moment. Do you draw on your years of experience as an international journalist when you develop these plot lines?
Look, I do. I think just my own experience. There's some corporate shenanigans in this book that I sort of draw upon some experience as a reporter. I think this is something that crime writers often do. They almost unconsciously, they tap into things that are current, that are topical, often things that are of concern in the community. So 20 years ago it might, or 30 years ago it might have been serial killers, 20 years ago it might have been Islamic terrorists. Right now there's a lot of crime fiction books that are addressing the very serious problems that Australia has with domestic violence. You know, this is coming out off the back of the Me Too movement. So I think crime writing often does just pick up on things of concern in the community. So one, for example, that is touched on in my previous book, Trust, but again, to some, a little bit in this one, is just concerns we have with political corruption. As you've seen on everything from Four Corners to ICAC to whatever, what's going on in federal politics. So, I think inevitably I'm drawing on my own experience, but also just what's out there, what's topical in the news at the moment.
And we're speaking today with Chris Hammer, who is the author of a new book called Treasure and Dirt, an absolute thriller set in outback New South Wales. Chris, we've reached the stage of the program where we ask our guests to pick a song. Have you got one for us?
Yeah, look, I was thinking Digging the Dirt by Peter Gabriel. I've always liked his music ever since he did Sledgehammer. Digging in the dirt to find the places we got hurt is the kind of refrain in the song. So I think that fits his story pretty well.
Thank you.
And that was Digging in the Dirt by Peter Gabriel, specially chosen for us today by our special guest, Chris Hammer, who is the author of a new book called Treasure and Dirt. Chris, we were just talking about how the book is divided into days, and I find that quite helpful because there's so much going on. And the other thing I noticed is that your characters seem to have unusual names like Topsoil and Humphrey Tuppence and Bullwinkle. Were you doing that to make it easier to work out the relationship? Because they certainly stick in your mind.
Look, to be honest, those rather eccentric, rather over-the-top Dickensian names, they're pretty much in all my books. And I started off, I think, when I was writing my first book, Scrublands. I was working full-time in a full-time job, so I was writing in the evenings. I think I just got a bit bored and I started using these rather eccentric names. And then when Scrublands came out and was quite successful, I felt a bit awkward about it, you know, a bit sheepish, until a woman at an event came up to me and said she really liked the names. They were very distinctive. And because that book, like this book, has multiple plot lines, it helped her keep track of which character was which. Mm. And I thought, you know what, she's right. So I think it does help keep track of the storylines. So it was a happy accident that having done it. And the other thing about this book is there are continuing characters from some of the previous books. They just pop up as very minor mentions. But it'd be a bit weird if all the continuing characters had these sort of outlandish names and all the new ones had very kind of commonplace, you know, vanilla sort of names. So I decided it was something I should lean into. And, you know, I think you're right. I think it helps readers keep track of the plots.
And the other thing I notice is that it's not set out exactly when this all happened, but you don't make any mention of COVID, which, of course, is all we talk about most of the time. Was that a deliberate move to not talk about COVID?
Well, not so much. It just came out in the writing. My previous book, Trust, I just finished it and we started editing at the start of last year and COVID hit. My problem with Trust then was there was lots of references to the recent bushfires. And I thought, well, how can I have all these references to the bushfires, you know, one kind of national disaster, if you like, and no reference to COVID. So Trust, there are quite a few mentions of COVID. This time, even though I was writing it more or less in lockdown, I just thought, well, I don't have a lot to say about COVID and it's not going to affect the plot. So I think there might be a passing reference or two, but certainly the story's not affected by COVID. And, you know, look, it wasn't really a conscious decision, but maybe, you know, readers will be happy about that. I think, you know, we're probably read enough about COVID.
I think you're right. I think, yes, perhaps you read these books for a bit of escape. So, yeah, you don't want to be confronted with COVID every page. And then, as you mentioned a little bit earlier, you delve into the worlds of big business and high finance and skullduggery on the stock market. I was just wondering, do you ever feel an obligation to show that crime doesn't pay?
No. I think people, when they're reading crime fiction, you need to resolve things. You need to reveal who did it. And there's probably a lot of people, there's a desire there to see justice done. So that's true to an extent. But in some ways, it can be just as interesting to realise, oh, my God, some people can get away with things. So in my books, probably a little bit of a mixture of both, I think.
Yeah, well, there are some questions left over at the end of the book. I think it is crying out for a sequel, but I guess that's all part of getting people thinking, isn't it? That you sort of trace the timeline forward in your own head as to what might have happened.
Look, that's right, and I think you're right about this might be the first book in a series. Not so much really about issues like that. It's just that as I was writing it, I just started to find Ivan and Nell much more interesting as people, you know, with their backstories and whatever, and I thought, well, it'd be kind of a shame just to leave them here. I mean, they've wrapped up the case in Finnegan's Gap as much as they can. Those multiple cases, they kind of have a very good idea of what's happened in all of them. And they've arrested people and all the rest of it. But I do think there's more to them, so I'm thinking I might write another book or two with them in it. And hopefully at some stage, I might also go back and revisit Martin and Mandy. Martin's interesting because he's a journalist, so that leads to a different type of story, whereas Ivan and Nell, of course, are police officers.
This drawing out of the characters is interesting, and the flaws are interesting. I mean, I'm not sure whether there are any characters you can, in this book anyway, that you can really warm to.
I do. I think most readers really warm to Ivan and Nell, particularly to Nell, for sure. I think that's part of the idea, that you want to feel for the characters, you want to identify with them. I don't like just having, you know, black and white. I don't like having baddies that are all bad and goodies that are all good. It helps to have a bit of nuance. And I think it's good to have protagonists that kind of have skin in the game, that are more like real people. You do get those kind of crime fiction books, you know, like the Agatha Christie books, Miss Marple. And they're really just very objective investigators that aren't really emotionally attached to the cases they're investigating. Whereas with my books, there is that emotional element there, and there's a bit of an emotional journey of the main characters. And I think, I don't know if all readers like that, but I think many readers like that kind of identifying with the characters and the dilemmas they face.
Yes, I mean, in saying whether you warm to them or not, I mean, I guess things have happened to both Nell and Ivan Lucic in their past that are still resonating, but you get the sense that perhaps they're going to resolve them at some stage and get to the other side.
Yeah, well, I hope so. And, you know, isn't that all of us? We've all got yes. things in our past that, you know, maybe we regret or could have done better, or, you know, we still carry with us.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny hearing you talk about these characters as though, you know, they really are people, I guess. And do they, like, say you go into a next book, do they just pop out of the word processor onto the page, and you sort of follow them as much as anybody else?
Look, that's a strange way of putting it, but in some ways it's true that they start off as kind of very two-dimensional people that are leading you through the story. But as the book develops, you know, they evolve and they become more and more real to me. So I might have a plot point, you know, that I'm thinking, oh, around this stage they might do this, and you get to it. And it doesn't happen because it is literally out of character that, you know, these people have developed to such a stage that you know what they would and would not do, what's acceptable to them. So, yeah, they do kind of take on a life of their own. And there are points when you're writing the book where it's almost, you're almost like channeling them. It's almost like you're reading it rather than writing it. I know that sounds a bit strange, but that can be how it happens.
Well, Michael Connelly is a leading American author of detective novels, and he describes you as a great writer, a leader in Australian noir. Is this a type of writing that is developing in Australia?
Look, it's often described as that. I'm often described as a writer of outback noir, although this is my fourth book and it's the first one that's actually set in the outback proper. Scrublands was set in a very drought-stricken irrigation town, but, you know, a farming community, so not strictly speaking the outback. There has been this, Bill, there's been this really big boom in crime fiction in Australia. It's always been there. There's been people like Gary Disher and Barry Maitland, Peter Temple, Peter Corris writing it over the years. But just recently, I think since Jane Harper's book, The Dry, was published in 2016, there's been quite a boom. It's very popular with readers now. And the really interesting thing, of course, is it's popular with readers not just in Australia, but increasingly with readers in the United States. then also in translation. So, yeah, it seems to be a real wave of, whether you call it Australian noir. Australian noir is probably a good descriptor because terms like rural noir and outback noir don't capture. There's some terrific books being written, of course, that are set in the city, Sydney, Melbourne, you know, Brisbane, Perth, wherever. So, but yeah, no, it's proving to be very popular at the moment, which of course makes me very happy.
Yes, well, we talk about noir, which is a French word meaning black, but it sort of describes, I don't know, mysteries. We talk about the Scandinavian noir. Now we've got the Australian noir. Is that the way you see it?
Yeah, it's usually like, you know, with the American sort of hard-boiled detective sort of film noir back in the 40s and 50s, black and white, and the French noir. So it's kind of that context of being a little bit gritty, a little bit, you know, tough. Certainly not that kind of cozy crime, you know, high tea in the mansion sort of type stuff. It's more down there in the street, or in this case, you know, down there in the mines and in the dirt.
Chris, we're just about out of time, but I do want to congratulate you on your book, Treasure and Dirt. It absolutely is a page turner, and it's, you know, it's quite a long book, but you don't notice it because you get through page after page. It's a great read. So congratulations on the book, and thank you very much for being a guest on Dad's on the Air.
Look, thanks so much for having me on Bill. I really appreciate it. Good on you.
Thank you. And don't forget, we'd love to hear from any of our listeners. You can go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au. Send us an email. We'll be in touch. If you'd like to listen to this show again or any of our shows, go to your favourite podcast app or our website, dadsontheair.com.au, or you can follow us on Facebook or Twitter. And we'll be back next week with another show on Dad's on the Air.